So tonight I'm going to be talking about humility. The lecture is called Humility Part 2, Reflections on a Shy Virtue. There was a Humility Part 1 last term, which I'll give you a little bit of review in a few minutes on that, just so you know where we've been. If we use the Bible as a guide to understand who God is, it would seem that humility is a virtue in people that God cares about more than anything else, almost. And I'm just going to do something just to give you sort of a taste of some of the things the Bible says about humility. I'm just going to read a bunch of biblical texts aloud to you. Some of them may be familiar, some of them not. And without a whole lot of interpretation, we're just going to walk through a couple of things just to give you a sense of the breadth of things the Bible says about humility. For those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. This is something Jesus says in Matthew 23. He says it in three other places as well in the Gospels. A couple weeks ago, Dick mentioned this as, you know, if there's any such thing as a spiritual law in the Bible, this is it. Those who exalt themselves will be humbled. Those who humble themselves will be exalted. Exodus 10:3 says, Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said to him, "This is what the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, says. How long will you refuse to humble yourself before me? Let my people go so they may worship me." Daniel 5, starting in verse 20. This is talking about the king Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king. "But when his heart became arrogant and hardened with pride, he was deposed from his royal throne and stripped of his glory. He was driven away from people and given the mind of an animal. He lived with the wild donkeys and ate grass like the ox. And his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he acknowledged that the Most High God is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and sets over them anyone he wishes. But you, Belshazzar, his son, have not humbled himself. You have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. Instead, you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven." This is the writing on the wall passage, where we get that expression, seeing the writing on the wall. Micah chapter 6, verses 6 through 8. "With what shall I come before the Lord and bow down before the exalted God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000 rivers of olive oil? Shall I offer my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has shown you, O mortal, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God." Proverbs 3, verse 34 says, "He mocks proud mockers, but shows favor to the humble and oppressed." And a little bit later in Proverbs, chapter 16, this one is a challenge to me. "Better to be lowly in spirit along with the oppressed than to share the plunder of the proud." And then passage out of Proverbs. "The Lord tears down the house of the proud, but he sets the widow's boundary stones in place." So, this is just a bunch of, like I said, uninterpreted Bible passages, but just to get you to almost sort of whet our appetite a little bit in terms of what the kind of things that the Bible says about both pride and humility. Humility in people is really, really, really important to God. It's a virtue which is really, really important for us to seek after. But what is it? What is it that we're aiming for? And how do we get to it? And like I said before, this is the second part of a series. The first part, I spent the whole lecture talking about things that humility is not. Because I think a lot of things get called humility, and we think of a lot of things as humility that really are not. And if we strive with these false humilities as our goal, we'll actually fail to live in a way that God never actually called us to in the first place, and so it's sort of a double failure, and it can do a lot of damage. And so I talked about three areas of false humility. false humility regarding our accomplishments in life. This is a humility that denies our agency or involvement in any of the things that we have done. This is what I think most typically gets referred to as false humility. It's the need to push away compliments or encouragement for fear of being prideful and say, oh, no, it wasn't me, or oh, it was just God, or these kinds of things. That's one area, I think, of false humility regarding our accomplishments. The second area is regarding our moral failure or a sin. And this is a humility, I'm saying humility in quotes here, that claims we are too broken to be forgiven. We are beyond help. And ultimately, this is can be a prideful rejection of grace. And thirdly, another false humility is regarding our knowledge. And this is a humility that shies away from any strong convictions about anything at all. Because to have any strong convictions or to claim you have any knowledge is intrinsically arrogant. And so we shouldn't do that. And that is a very contemporary, secular definition of humility, which Christians are not actually called to. We're called to actually be certain of some things, and our humility actually rests on certainty about some things. So, in these three areas, our accomplishments, our sin, and our knowledge, true humility is really, really important, and so these false humilities can get us in a lot of trouble and be quite destructive. That's all the review that I'm going to give. The lecture is available on our website if you want to check it out. But tonight, in some ways, I found this lecture much harder just to prepare because it's talking about what humility actually is. And it's much easier to talk about what it's not. There's a recent book by David Brooks called The Road to Character. And he spends a lot of time in the book talking about humility as a necessary ingredient to character growth. And he follows the stories of various different people, sort of mini biographies, really talking in one way or another about humility. And he praises, in the beginning of his book, he praises humility in a couple ways. And I want to walk through these very briefly just as a way of beginning this lecture. He calls humility aesthetically beautiful. It appeals to us when we see it in other people. There's something deeply attractive about humility in a way there's not about arrogance. There's something appealing about it when we see it in other people. Brooks says that it's intellectually impressive too. When people are humble, they are hitting on the truth about their own ignorance, about their own limitation in knowledge. So one's own ignorance is not actually an easy thing to discover or believe in. So there's an intellectual victory when a person is humble. And thirdly, he calls it morally impressive. A life lived in humility is a journey of self-confrontation, he says. It's to be committed to confronting yourself again and again and again. It's an extended effort to bring oneself to conform to a moral standard outside the self, which will necessarily involve self-criticism. And he says this is a moral victory. This is morally impressive. And so I found his observations very helpful. He fleshes it out much more and with very specific examples in the biography section. So I really recommend the book, The Road to Character. And I want to just continue talking about humility and try to get more in depth as to what it is and how can we aim for it. One of the challenges in talking about humility is that it is a shy virtue. And so that is my weird title for tonight. What is shy about humility? What do I mean by that? This is a weird thing to talk about, but the band The Beatles, if you guys heard of The Beatles? George Harrison was always referred to as the quiet one, the quiet Beatle. He didn't enjoy the spotlight. He wasn't as charismatic as John Lennon and Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr. And yet, what would the Beatles have been without him? The quiet Beatle. All those great guitar parts and all that stuff. Forget it. So humility is the quiet one among the virtues, I think. But what would the Christian life be without it? Nothing. It all falls apart without humility. It's essential to the Christian life. Much more essential to the Christian life than George Harrison was to the Beatles. So the analogy is lame. But this is not to say that a person has to be shy to be humble. But the virtue itself is strangely elusive. It's elusive, I think, because it's surrounded by paradoxes. On the one hand, it is the essence or the foundation of all Christian virtues. I'll talk about that a little bit more later. It's a beautiful thing to observe in other people. We've all probably benefited from the humility of other people in our lives, if you think about it. It is humility that has led people to love us and show a genuine interest in us and serve us and care for us. Other people's humility. We've benefited from it. We've probably seen it as beautiful when we've had eyes to see it. But on the other hand, the moment we attempt to observe it in ourselves or monitor our growth in humility, the shy virtue kind of slinks off into the undergrowth. When we shine a light on our own characters, humility does not tolerate much analysis. When we take note of it in ourselves, there's a danger of losing the very thing we're taking note of. There's a philosopher named John Dixon who wrote a book on humility called Humilitas, A Lost Key to Life, Love, and Leadership. I've not read the whole book, but I read the first few pages, and I look forward to reading it in the future. Anyway, but in his introduction, he has this classic way. He very concisely states what I was just saying. I think that the title of his introduction is Humility, How I Achieved It. Anyway, and he says this. There is an obvious conundrum facing the writer and readers of a book on humility. Does the author think he has attained this difficult virtue? If so, he almost certainly hasn't. If not, why is he writing a book on the topic? Humility stands alone among the virtues in that as soon as you think you have it, you probably don't. And yet the reverse does not follow. Not thinking yourself humble is no indication that you are. You might be right. Both the arrogant and the humble are unlikely to think of themselves as humble. So how could you ever know if you have attained the virtue? Anyway, I love the way he writes. This is true for several reasons. I just have to say this is sort of how I feel about lecturing on the topic. I haven't done anything so grand as write a book on it, but when you get up to talk about humility and give people a word about humility, it's a strange thing. It feels odd. Who has the authority to talk about humility? If we think we do, we don't. So that's just a little disclaimer. This is true, I think, for several reasons. First of all, humility is essentially an awareness of a lack. It's an acknowledgement of a poverty or a need or some kind of inadequacy in ourselves. That's what humility is. It's an awareness of a lack. To claim you are just fine in the humility department is to claim that you see no lack in yourself. And this is not humility. This is, the Bible would describe that as blindness. But there's another reason. The more time we spend monitoring our own humility, the more we're just thinking about ourselves. And there's a beautiful self-forgetfulness, which is somehow essential to true humility. The actual humble person doesn't waste time thinking about their own humility. And you remember I said all of us have probably benefited in one way or another from the humility of other people. It impacts how they treat us. What if those people had been preoccupied with whether or not they were being sufficiently humble? They would not have loved us very well. They would not have cared for us very well. They would have been thinking about themselves. So, this is the conundrum. Humility is, on the one hand, a kind of self-awareness. It's an awareness of what we lack. But on the other hand, it's also a reluctance to think about ourselves any more than is necessary. So it's both a self-knowledge and self-forgetfulness. And it seems like a real paradox, and I think in some ways it is, but it's something that is real, and we can't really get away from it. It's both of those things. It's a kind of self-awareness, and it's a kind of self-forgetfulness. Another paradox that comes up, I think, again and again for me, is that humility is necessary for growth. We need a measure of it to learn anything at all. So only the teachable person learns things. And yet, it's also the chief end of growth in Christian terms. Humility is the very thing into which God is calling us to grow. That's what we need to grow in, humility. So we need to grow towards humility, and we need it in order to grow. And which comes first? And I think we can sort of discuss these things in the discussion time after the lecture. But I think most of us probably know, on some level, humility is not a black and white thing that you have or you don't have. It's is a lifelong process of growth and with many setbacks. But my outline will be a bit stream of consciousness tonight because I found humility very, very hard to pin down, and I feel like I'm just going to be offering scattered thoughts about it. Each section of the lecture will basically be an aspect of what humility is or what humility does, the fruit of humility. And so here's the outline. It has a bunch of sections. Can you see the bottom? Each section really is the answer to humility as. Humility as this, humility as that. I'm going to move lightly over a lot of ground because it is a very, very, very broad topic. My hope is that overall we'll see the amazing continuity of biblical teaching on humility. The Bible is not ambiguous about it. We get the same story from beginning to end in the Bible about its importance. And my other hope is that we'll be able to connect some of this biblical wisdom with real-life observations that we have. There's a lot of extra-biblical evidence for why humility is a good way to live. And that's one of the reasons that the Bible is such a source of wisdom. It's about real life. So, first and foremost, humility, living the truth honestly. Humility as living the truth honestly. The Bible tells us true things about ourselves. But some of those true things are not easy to hear. To accept these things requires humility, and when we do accept them, it actually leads to more humility. So from the Bible's perspective, to be humble is to simply recognize our true condition. Humility is an appropriate response to what is real, much in the way that thankfulness is an appropriate response to what is real. There's two main reasons I think that humility is appropriate for people. We are both finite and sinful. Finite means that we are small and limited. We are weak and dependent. In the grand scheme of the universe, we were born very, very recently, and we will die very, very soon. That's just a fact. I'm not being mean or morbid. We are creatures, and we did not make ourselves, but we receive our existence from outside ourselves. We're confined to space and time in a way that God is not confined. And many of the tasks in life that we have before us are beyond us. Our capacities are small. We're limited. We're finite. Isaiah 40, verse 15 says, "Surely the nations are like a drop in a bucket. They are regarded as dust on the scales. He weighs the islands as though they were fine dust." So the image of a smooth surface, the scales, that you could blow the dust off of it. To God, that's what the nations are like. So, to tell us something about ourselves, right? None of us is a nation, even. We are very, very small. And even the nations are a drop in the bucket. These are just a few aspects of what our finitude means, the fact that we're finite. Notice that these are not actually moral issues. We're not at fault for being small. We were meant to be dependent creatures. It's something that we're actually supposed to embrace. We're meant to love our dependence on God. It's not an unfortunate temporary state of affairs like if we move back in with our parents while we pay off our student loans or something like that. That kind of dependence, we sort of want to get over it. Our dependence on God is good and it's forever. And it's not a moral problem. That being said, to not acknowledge and embrace our finitude is a moral problem. So that's a refusal to accept a basic truth about ourselves, that we are dependent creatures. But we tend to have delusions of independence, and this is a problem. And that brings us to the second reason why humility is appropriate, because we are sinful. Being sinful means that we're morally broken. We've radically fallen short of how God would have us live and rebelled against Him. We are prone to all kinds of things, like pride. We are envious. We can be ungrateful, unloving. We're capable of amazing cruelty and indifference, to varying degrees maybe, but all of us have this in us. We actually like our delusions of not being finite, and we have become at home with our self-deception. And one of the overarching problems of the Bible attacks again and again throughout from beginning to end is idolatry. We make gods out of things that are not God. God demands things of us, and we have to submit to Him, and we cannot control Him, so we prefer smaller things that we can control. The Bible teaches us that all these things are aspects of our rebellion against God that originated at the fall. Sin is in us, and none of us are immune from it. There's a wonderful quote from Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He's talking about the unfortunate fact that we can't just get rid of evil in the world by isolating certain people, put them on an island somewhere. And the reason is, this is the quote, the line between good and evil runs through the middle of every human heart. How do you get rid of that? It's in you. My conflicted heart doesn't even allow me to see what's good and bad clearly all the time. So how in the world are we supposed to get rid of evil in the world if it runs through the middle of me? So sin is a moral failure in a way that finitude is not. Being finite is just being dependent. That's how God made us. Sin was a departure from how God made us, and was really an imposter in God's good creation. Humility means a lot of things, but it's never anything less than acknowledging these two realities and trying to live out the truth of these two realities, that we're finite and we're sinful. And one of the ways in which we live out and acknowledge that is that we bow to God in these two areas. And this is the insight that Francis Schaeffer had. So this is his terminology. We bow to God metaphysically because we're finite, and then we bow to Him again morally because we're sinful. We bow twice to God in a sense, metaphysically because we're dependent on Him, morally because we are sinful. So we bow metaphysically because we're dependent on God in every sense. This is to acknowledge that we are not God, but we're His creatures and have nothing apart from His generosity. So it is a bow that involves gratitude. That's part of the metaphysical bow. Gratitude. Life is a gift, and we didn't make it ourselves. We just received it. Then we also bow morally because we've been rebellious. And this bow, I think, acknowledges God's holiness and our failure at holiness. So it's a bow that involves letting go of our delusions of being able to live a blameless life. It also involves letting go of our delusions that we can make it right ourselves, that we can compensate for our screw-ups before God and somehow get back in His good books by our hard work. This is a bow, the moral bow, that asks for forgiveness. And for the Christian, it's really a bow before the cross of Christ. The cross is God's chosen way to rescue us from the consequences of our sin. And at the very heart of the gospel is the fact that we were powerless to help ourselves in this, but that Jesus Christ willingly received the full punishment for our sin, setting us completely free from the guilt of our sin. So the cross, I think, is both an amazing indicator to us of our need. This was necessary for you, for me. It indicates our need. But it's also the great provision for our need at the same time. So we see our need and the depth of it at the cross. We also see our need met at the cross. Humility is needed for us to bow before the cross. It's needed for us to accept the message of the cross. Without a sense of our need for mercy, the cross will always seem a bit melodramatic and manipulative to us. What do you mean? I'm not that bad, right? It will only seem like an overblown solution to a problem we don't really have. That's what the cross seems like to many people today. A big, melodramatic solution to a problem I don't have. But not only is humility needed to approach the cross at all, humility actually is the fruit of bowing at the cross. We grow in humility when we come to the cross. It's the only right response to God's power and love that He displays at the cross. That He would consider us that valuable should humble us. So we need to approach with a measure of humility, and I think we come away with deeper humility when we've really come to the cross. And there's an enormous amount at stake for us in living the truth honestly. I've been talking about humility as living the truth honestly. Our salvation is at stake in living the truth honestly. Maybe this is why Jesus puts such a very high value on us growing in humility, on meekness, on lowliness. He spent most of his time with people who could not pretend that they were anything other than lowly. And those people are the ones that seem to have seen Jesus clearly. That lowliness allowed the poor and the sick and the religious outcast to recognize Jesus for who he was. Their lowliness. And a lot of Jesus' teaching could be summarized by the words, if you think you can please God in your own strength, get lower. You can't. Without an awareness and an acceptance of our need, the riches of the gospel are not available to us. And so humility in this sense is a sort of a spiritual bottom line. And if we decline the help that God has offered us, we actually are without hope. And so it's a very serious thing. Humility is not just a some sort of life choice we can take or leave as Christians. But it raises a difficult question for me, which is, if we say our salvation depends on humility, isn't this just another way of saying that our salvation depends on something we bring to God? It's something to do with our righteousness and our works. And I've struggled with how to articulate this, because it's a hard thing to me. But So I'm going to bumble through this section. But it seems to me there's a very, very basic self-awareness that is nothing more than saying help to God. It's not a dramatic feat of humility. It's not a life of perfect humility lived out, because none of us are capable of that. All of us are engaged in a battle against pride our whole lives, and we have many setbacks. And if our salvation depended on perfect humility before God, we'd be lost. There's no question. But there is this very basic acknowledgement that we need help. We need help in our pride, which is really essential to the gospel, essential to receiving the gift of the gospel. So I think maybe the humblest prayer any of us can really offer to God is, I am proud, help. That's the maybe the difference between a Christian and not a Christian, is the ability to say that, to say help, even softly. And so I'm not trying to say that, you know, our salvation depends on humility. I don't mean by that we are supposed to live a perfect life of humility. That is our goal, but it is not possible for us. Anyway, I hope that's confusing enough for you. But it's hard to get away from the biblical witness of this. I'm not just making this up. It's all over the Bible. I'm just going to give you three examples from the gospel, from the gospels, different gospels. The first one is from Luke 18. To some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee, another a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God, I thank you that I am not like other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get. But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. And this is worth long reflection, obviously, but I'll just say one thing. Spiritual resumes are not just useless before God. They are a liability before God. The Pharisee is still under God's judgment. He goes home with nothing more than what he came with, a list of things he's proud about that are of absolutely no help to him at all. He has not made himself available to the mercy of God, which is what he needs. He does not think he needs the only thing he really needs. The tax collector, in contrast, receives the full riches of forgiveness because he brings nothing and he knows it. So this is what's often been called the empty hands of faith. This is the only way we receive the riches of the gospel, God's forgiveness, is if we come with empty hands. We can't be holding on to anything else and receive it at the same time. Again, in Mark 10, people were bringing little children to Jesus for him to place his hands on them, but the disciples rebuked him. When Jesus saw this, he was indignant. He said to them, "Let the little children come to me. Do not hinder them, for the kingdom of God belongs to such as these. Truly I tell you, anyone who will not receive the kingdom of God like a little child will never enter it." And he took the children in his arms, placed his hands on them, and blessed them. So this is, again, powerful language. But I think it's incredible what he's saying. I think what he's saying is basically children cannot pretend anything, really. They know they are dependent. They're not equipped to pretend they're not dependent, the way adults are. We have more ways of pretending that we are independent. But children know what they need, and they cry out for it, and they make no attempt to pay their parents back for it. They just receive it. There's a raw kind of need that a small child has, particularly an infant, and they just yell until you help them. And that's it. No delusions of self-sufficiency at all. And actually, I think one of the things Jesus is getting at is this is where we all are, actually. We just don't realize it. And so it's not about children being more needy than adults. It's about children not being able to pretend they're anything other than needy. Whereas we develop all kinds of layers of deception as we grow up and think we can do without God. But anyway, that kind of raw need is almost a kind of transparency that we should all aim for. No pretense at all. We just need the Lord. In John 13, he came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" Jesus replied, "You do not realize now what I am doing, but later you will understand." "No," said Peter, "you shall never wash my feet." Jesus answered, "Unless I wash you, you have no part with me." There's more before that and there's more after that, but that's just the middle section. Peter, in seeming humility, doesn't want Jesus to dirty his hands with such an undignified job. It's below the status of the rabbi to do such a thing. But beneath this, I think, is the belief that he doesn't really need to be washed, or at least his need to be washed is not on the forefront of his mind. There's this sense in which he can sort of hang out in the presence of God without being purified. He doesn't really understand what this foot washing symbolizes yet. But there's something very, very profound going on here. The humility of letting yourself be served is hard, particularly served by Jesus for Peter. And yet, without allowing ourselves to be served by Jesus, we're lost. We have no part with him. So these are just a few biblical examples of how to be humble is actually in our eternal best interest. There is an eternal benefit for us. Our salvation depends on us perceiving our need. And none of us can perceive the complete depth of our need, but God is merciful. And again, like I said before, we need to say help. The point here is that to be humble in light of our being finite and in light of our sin is simply acknowledging the truth about ourselves. It's honest living. When finite, sinful people are proud, it's not just breaking a rule. It's not just being bad or something like that. It's dishonest. It's self-deception. Pride is self-deception. It's living a lie. And yet, it's our perennial problem. We struggle with it. We embrace it, and we resist humility. I'm going to move on to our second section here, which is humility as a relational virtue. The purpose of humility is knowing God, I think. And that's what I mean by a relational virtue in this case. There's different aspects of it, I think, but it's necessary for a relationship with him. To know this God for who he really is, we need to actually know ourselves. And if we are deceived about ourselves, we won't actually see God clearly. And this is why the Bible often refers to pride as blindness. When we're proud, we don't actually see ourselves or God at all. It's an interesting thing to read the Gospel of John and look at the metaphor of blindness that goes throughout the whole Gospel. And spiritual blindness is usually pride. It's the people who think they have it together and they are blind. And yet, to know ourselves rightly, we must know this God, because God is the one who undeceives us about ourselves. It's in the light of His glory that we see ourselves for what we really are. We're small, we're broken, but also valuable. And this is an insight that we often talk about here, that John Calvin had in the beginning of the Institutes. He wasn't sure which was more essential and which preceded the other. Self-knowledge that leads to God-knowledge, or God-knowledge that leads to self-knowledge. The two are so interdependent that it's really impossible to say which comes first. You can't have one without the other, in both directions. At La Brie, we often have conversations with people about what it means to have a relationship with God. What does that mean? Personal relationship. What does it mean that He desires a relationship with us? What does that mean that we're supposed to have a relationship with someone who's infinite and invisible? These are hard questions. But one thing I think is certain in the Bible, without humility on our part, there's no possibility of relationship with God. We won't even see Him. And so humility is the only way we can know God, see God, and relate to God rightly. If we approach God in prayer with pride, or with some sense that we're entitled to His attention, or that He's lucky to hear from us, or any of these ways we can pray sometimes, we might not be actually talking to the real God who's there. So the Bible is clear that God listens to the humble. He makes Himself known to the lowly. He lavishes amazing attention on people who know they are weak. There's a wonderful passage in Daniel 10 that I stumbled upon. Daniel's having this vision of a divine being. It's an angel or some sort of vision of God. And he's terrified of this person whose clothes are like lightning and eyes are like flames. And he falls on the ground, is unable to move. He's paralyzed with fear. He's touched on the shoulder and he's given the strength to stand. It takes a couple of times for him to have the strength to stand up. And then he's told this: "Do not be afraid, Daniel. Since the first day that you set your mind to gain understanding and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come in response to them." This is a beautiful, very concise picture of what humility gives us access to. Daniel has sought true understanding of God, which was by definition to humble himself. That's what true understanding of God is. And as a result, the Lord of the universe listens to him and even responds to his prayers. His prayers make a difference in the real world. And there's access to a relationship because Daniel's humbled himself. That's one way in which humility is a relational virtue. It's the only way that we relate to God. How else is it a relational virtue? Humility, I think, is always in relation to something else. This is maybe a little bit more abstract, but no one is humble in a universal sense, I don't think. People humble themselves before particular things. And so the question really is, the question really is humble in relation to what? Before what are we humble? Many physicists, to their credit, are struck with humility as they study the universe and they uncover the vastness, the complexity, and the order of it. This is good. They're struck with a true sense of their smallness and the limits of their understanding. But it's not exactly the same thing as humbling themselves before the God who made the galaxies and holds them in place. It can lead to that. It sometimes does lead to that, but it's not the same thing. Because Christian humility looks a very particular way because it has a particular object in mind. Christians are called to be humble before the living God who has revealed himself to us. So Humility is a response to who he is. And this is where our theology actually really matters. How we think about God. Who is he? How has he revealed himself? They have very practical, relational implications, I think. And this is what I mean. Let's give a couple examples. God is the giver of all good things, and we are always in the place of receiving. In light of his generosity, we are called to humble gratitude. Gratitude is one of the great fruit of humility. To accept his gifts and acknowledge that we have received blessings from him. So gratitude should be a distinct mark of Christian humility because of who God is. He is the giver. We are the receivers. God is the creator and designer of the vast, diverse, and beautiful world full of strange things. It's before his majesty and creativity that we are humble as creatures. Particularly, I think, some of us who try to make things, who are artists and everything, we're our creativity is humbled before his. So wonder should be the mark of Christian humility because God is the creator and the designer of everything we see. He is the one who made it. And it goes on and on and on. I think the Christian is told in the Bible that we have tremendous grounds for confidence that we're loved and approved and accepted. That's the ground we're standing on. And one of the marks of Christian humility is a peace about that. And not all of us have this in equal measure, but a peace that enables us to survive criticism from other people because of where our approval really rests. So that's another mark of distinctive Christian humility as opposed to some vague universal thing. This is all to say that Christian humility does not stand alone. It's always a relational response to God and what he's done. And I think this is actually one of the helpful ways of thinking about humility as opposed to self-hatred. We sometimes think that to be really humble, we have to somehow despise ourselves. It's all about turning inward and hating what we see in ourselves. Unless we can do that, then we're not being humble. But it's not at all what biblical humility is. It's actually turning outwards towards our Creator, who is holy and majestic and powerful and good. The one who knows us and yet loves us. And it's in light of these things that humility grows. It's not about looking inward and despising ourselves. So that's another way in which humility is relational. It's always in relation to something. We humble ourselves before something. And this is one of the sobering things in all the biblical texts about humility. There are the people who humble themselves, which is good. And then there's the people who are humbled by God. And this is the choice before us. Do you choose to humble yourself now, or are you going to be humbled one day? Because everyone's going to be humbled one day. You either start now, or you'll be humbled later. And so our calling is to humble ourselves now. We have everything to gain from humbling ourselves now. So, another way in which humility is relational, I think, in the sphere of human relationships. Do I have the wrong slide here? Oh, there we go. One of the great fruits of humility is better relationships with each other. This may be the most obvious part of my lecture, but I'll say a bunch of obvious things anyway. I think humility is the main reason why there are any healthy relationships between people. That goes for friendships and marriages, parent-child relationships, relationships that bridge cultural and generational and racial divides. Humility is maybe the only reason why any of these relationships are healthy at all. So Christians, I think, shouldn't be naive. We shouldn't expect perfect relationships, but humility is sort of this hidden, shy virtue behind everything that's good between people, I think. I think that the reason for this is that it's the foundation under every other virtue. If you think of the fruit of the Spirit that Paul lays out in Galatians, there's a song that my kids sing. I asked them to come down to my office and sing it to me a little while ago to make sure I had them all in the right order. Mm-hmm. The fruit of the Spirit. I could have looked it up, but I asked them to come down and sing it to me. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. And try to imagine any of these things without humility at their core. What does patience look like without humility? What does joy look like without humility? What does self-control look like without humility? It's impossible to do that, really, if you think about it. It's this sort of bedrock necessity. If there's to be any other virtue, humility is somehow at the level of bedrock. Without humility, our relationships are strained, fractious, dishonest, and lacking in trust, or they just die altogether. We don't have them. And so, what are some of the ways, just to flesh it out a little bit more, what are some of the ways that humility is important to human relationships? And again, these may be obvious, but listening. The humble person really listens and takes the other person's thoughts and experiences seriously. My perspective is not the ultimate perspective. It's not the only one that matters. Maybe there's truth in what someone else is saying that had not occurred to me before. Maybe there's more to this other person that I could have perceived at a glance. Maybe I'm actually blind to something that this other person can teach me, something that I need to know. If I do not have humility, I will not feel a need to listen to anybody at all. Why should I? So in conversations, the other person should listen to my insights and stories. And I'm the one who has something interesting to share. I'm the one who should be in the position of teacher. And all these attitudes may actually come from deep insecurities within me. I may be terribly afraid and desperate to prove myself in conversation. But whatever the motivation, I will not be viewing the other person with humility. And I won't really be listening to them at all. At best, I'll be waiting to talk. And this won't actually be a very deep relationship, will it? People can usually tell that we're waiting to talk rather than listening. A few weeks ago, we had a unique lecture here in this room. The topic was Christianity, the white man's religion, given by a Nigerian-American guy named Abba, a friend of ours, who was just addressing this whole issue of in contemporary world today, viewing Christianity as something that's for white people. There were a lot of black people and a lot of white people in the room that night. And the discussion turned towards racial reconciliation. It was all over the place, but that was one of the things that came up. And there was a comment that came up several times, and I'm kind of lumping them, sort of paraphrasing this comment because I thought it was significant. And it went something like this. The most helpful thing in the whole fractious world of race relations would be for more white people to have the humility to simply listen to the stories of real African Americans and get a sense of what people's lives are really like. So another way of saying this is that there need to be actual relationships between black and white people for there to be any hope of reconciliation, to have the humility to listen to each other is the first step towards a real relationship. Otherwise, there's no hope for a real relationship with anybody across any dividing line. Listening. What else? And I'll mention these just very briefly in passing. Accepting help. The humility of accepting help from other people is one of the things that draws people together. It's one of the things that knits community together. People who are willing to give help and accept help. Not just about giving help. We need to accept help from people as well. That takes humility, and without it, relationships suffer. Rejecting help is a kind of pride, or can be sometimes. Asking for forgiveness. This takes humility. Sometimes it takes more humility than we have. But what relationship can thrive and be healthy without each person being willing to admit when they've been wrong and ask forgiveness? That actually, we could talk about that for hours, but I'm moving on. Not judging others. First of all, Jesus said not to do it, so that's important to us. But probably because of the inevitable stance of pride that we have when we judge someone else. We implicitly place ourselves morally above another person when we judge them. So actually, the gospel, if we've actually internalized the message of the gospel, doesn't really allow us to be self-righteous, because we're aware of the way in which we stand on equal footing with every other person. We are equal recipients of grace. But there are also relational implications here, because how often do you feel drawn to and want to spend time with people in whose presence you feel judged? Not often. That's not the basis for a good relationship. So self-righteousness, sort of spiritual pride that is really destructive to relationships. So lastly, I just want to mention something, a writing of Paul's in Ephesians 4, where he draws a connection between humility and unity in the church. There can't really be any unity in the church if people are not living humbly before each other. He says a lot of things in this short passage, but he says, as a prisoner for the Lord, then I urge you to live a life worthy of the calling you have received. Be completely humble and gentle. Be patient, bearing with one another in love. Make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit through the bond of peace. There is one body and one Spirit, just as you were called to one hope when you were called. One Lord, one faith, one baptism. Amazing thing he's saying, that there is a spiritual unity that exists in the church. It's real. But we don't display it or show it to the world in any way unless we actually live in a unified way, in a way that loves each other, in a way that is humble. So humility is portrayed here as an essential ingredient to the unity in the church. Again, cruising very quickly. Third section, humility as fruit grown by God. To grow in humility is a lifelong process. I've already said that a couple times, but no one is a self-made humble person. Humility is something that's grown in us by God, and it's the result of His working on us, sometimes over a long, long time. And so I like the image of fruit. It's appropriate because fruit is something that we bear. We bear fruit as we mature, but God is the gardener. He's the one that grows it in us. And if all the stories are true, when people do actually grow in humility, it's often something that they were not approaching directly. They approached it indirectly. They didn't aim for it. They didn't set out to get humble. They found humility as they were stumbling along some difficult road in life. It was something that God worked in them in the midst of hard circumstances, most of which were out of their control. I mean, we often grow in humility through experiences that we would not have chosen if it had been up to us. But God uses those things to humble us. To grow in humility is a victory in God's eyes, I think. Maybe the main victory that He desires for us. Sometimes it seems like God is more interested in our humility than in any other victory in our lives. It's precious fruit to Him. We may desire other victories, but the problem is what is a victory in His eyes might actually look like failure and disappointment and humiliation and weakness to us. Times when we feel like we don't even know ourselves, times when some aspect of our sin or our vanity or our selfishness has been exposed and we see ourselves in an unflattering way, and other people do also, painful experiences like that, the least victorious moments of our lives, might be the most fruitful in God's eyes, because God is the one who defines what fruit is, and humility is precious in His eyes. This is really hard to accept, I think, most of the time. We talk about wanting to grow in humility, but very few of us want the kinds of experiences that would actually grow us in humility. We want to be humble, but also to move from strength to strength, from victory to victory, from promotion to promotion, from popularity to more popularity, never being embarrassed or ashamed or exposed. And this might be impossible, to both be humble and to move from strength to strength our whole life. Paul's example from his own life is in 2 Corinthians 12. He's talking about the thorn in his flesh, which is, he doesn't say what it means, but there's many, many theories as to what he's talking about. But he says this, three times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me, but he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Paul is talking about God growing him in humility. To the Lord, it is more important that Paul grow in his dependence on Christ and his awareness of his dependence on Christ than it is for Paul to receive a healing. Whatever that means. Paul identifies bad experiences as opportunities to know his weakness and display the glory of God. So when he's stripped down and completely unable to boast about himself, then he can boast in Christ. And this is very challenging, this idea that you can delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships. How many of us are welcome those kinds of things in our lives? It's not that those things are good. But he's saying that it's in those moments that we actually see clearly that we are weak and we are dependent on God's strength and we can boast in Christ. All throughout the Bible, God is doing the work of humbling people for their own good. Recently, I sort of slogged through Ezekiel. I'd never done it before, reading the whole book from beginning to end. And one of the things that I noticed, amidst a lot of very, very terrible prophetic predictions about God's judgment, about cities burning, horrible things, there's this refrain that comes up again and again and again, and it is this: then you will know that I am the Lord. Usually at the end of some dire prediction of what will happen to the city. But the impact throughout the whole book is really powerful. Then you will know that I'm the Lord. Then you will know that I'm the Lord. Even in judgment, God is teaching. He's trying to teach them to strip away their self-deception. Because of his great love for us, he's committed to teaching us that we are not God, and he is. And this is hard won. This is hard won fruit. In our own lives, it was hard won fruit for Israel. Humility as core strength. Earlier I talked about to be humble is in our eternal best interest. It's also in our best interest right now in this life, even today. Life will go better for you if you are humble. I think there's all kinds of evidence to suggest that pride and self-obsession makes miserable, insecure people. Self-promotion and what we call impression management, trying to manage the impression that everybody has of you, are massive preoccupations that actually leave us in a very, very precarious place in life. David Brooks, in his book I mentioned earlier, The Road to Character, he says this, and he's talking about the vulnerability of pride. Vulnerability in a bad sense, the precariousness of pride. As we go through life, most of us are constantly comparing and constantly finding ourselves slightly better than other people. More virtuous, with better judgment, with better taste. We're constantly seeking recognition and painfully sensitive to any snub or insult to the status we believe we have earned for ourselves. And so it's this painful sensitivity to any snub or insult that I think is the mark of pride. He's right. The more proud we are, the more sensitive and anxious we often are. If we are self-inflated, there's always the fear of punctures and being deflated. So pride, in a sense, makes us brittle. A hard knock can shatter us. Humility, in contrast, provides, I think, a protection, strength, and resilience in the face of disappointment. It makes people, I think, durable for real life. humble person can withstand a lot. And I'll just give a couple of examples of what I mean. A humble person does not feel entitled to an easy life. When hard experiences come, they are not overcome with a sense of grievance or bitterness or self-pity. They can bear up. There's no reason why hardship should not have happened to them. I think, in contrast, pride turns to rage in the face of disappointments, because there's a sense in which there's a right that has been denied, there's a grievance. Whereas humility, the protection from that vulnerability. There's this interesting one-liner out of the book of Proverbs 21, which said, "The proud and arrogant person, mocker is his name, behaves with insolent fury." And I don't know whether that's what Proverbs is getting at, but maybe. Pride and arrogance and mockery and disdain for the world around you ends with anger and rage. It doesn't lead anywhere healthy and good. Another example, a humble person is resilient when rebuked, or at least more resilient when rebuked. They never thought of themselves as particularly virtuous or above reproach in the first place. So when a humble person is criticized, there is an amazing freedom to listen and consider whether or not the criticism is valid. They can respond calmly rather than react defensively. They can apologize where necessary without their world falling apart. I think a humble person can take criticism because they weren't inflated or propped up in the first place. The humble person has already engaged in a life of self-criticism. So, like David Brooks was saying, the humble life is a life of self-confrontation. If that's a life that you are living, criticism from the outside, it might be discouraging still, but it's not totally destabilizing to you, because you're already in the process of confronting yourself about your own problems. So the humble person can carry on in the face of rebuke from other people, and there's a resilience in this, which I think is really amazing and good. Psalm 141, this is just a section out of the middle of Psalm 141, which says this: "Let a righteous man strike me, that is a kindness. Let him rebuke me, that is oil on my head. My head will not refuse it, for my prayer will still be against the deeds of evildoers." But there's a way in which he's welcoming rebuke from a wise person, because he's aware that he could be taught something. Even if it stings, rebuke from a wise person is something that he wants to receive. But it only takes humility to receive it like that. So one of the amazing strengths of humility, what I was referring to, humility as core strength, a humble person hasn't been pretending anything, which means that they're not in fear of life circumstances exposing their real self. A humble person can relax, in a sense, about who they are. To me, this sounds really good. Like, I want more of this. This kind of resilience, this kind of ability to be durable for real life. I had this past summer, I had a couple of learning experiences, two different sort of difficult conversations that stung a little bit for me. I was confronted once quite directly and then quite indirectly in another case, and I was just reflecting afterwards. They were both difficult, but I think good learning experiences for me. But I was reflecting after the fact how much easier those would have been if I had been more humble to start with. They wouldn't have stung so badly. I wouldn't have had this kind of ruffled feathers, this vanity that actually caused me more pain than I would have experienced had I been really humble and just been able to receive it as an insight into my life. moving along. We're getting there. Humility and self-forgetfulness. We already talked about this a little bit in the beginning. I think Lewis said this, but it's been quoted so many times that I forget. Maybe, Lenny, you could verify this. Humility is not thinking less of yourself, but thinking of yourself less. Timka, I think he was quoting Lewis, but I'm not sure. It's a safe bet he was quoting Jesus. I like that. It's not thinking less of yourself. So, like I said earlier, it's not about being introspective and looking inside yourself and hating yourself for what you see. It's just not thinking about yourself so much. Stop it. In other words, we're not called to a bad opinion of ourselves. That's not the goal of humility. We're called to just do it less. And that's the difference between self-hatred and self-forgetfulness. It's a world of difference. And self-forgetfulness is the essence of humility. But the point I want to make is that just not thinking about yourself is not a virtue by itself. The virtuous thing about not thinking about ourselves is what it allows us to do. It allows us to think much more about other people. So getting out of our own heads is great, but only because it enables us to develop what's called a sense of other. We talk about a sense of other sometimes. The passage in Ephesians I read before, in Ephesians 4, where Paul talks about humility and unity in the church, the word that's translated humble, one commentator defined it like this. He said, it's an attitude of mind that enables one to see people other than oneself, just to see them, is to take their existence as other seriously, to value their otherness. It's real. They are real. They're not just significant insofar as they impact you and your needs and desires. Their otherness is real. When we have an underdeveloped sense of other, we're usually not going around being mean and hurting people on purpose. It's usually not what it looks like. Sometimes it is. It's usually just an obliviousness towards other people altogether. It's an inability to get past thinking about our own issues, our own story, our own dreams, maybe our own grievances too. In comparison to all these very, very pressing things about me, other people just don't seem real. And we all act like this sometimes, I think. I'm not sure this is a true story, but a friend of mine told me this story about a guy who was in a bar. And he was trying to hit on a lady there. He wanted to take her home, probably, I don't know. But he was working hard that night, and after monologuing for a long, long time to this woman at the bar, he said, "That's enough about me. Let's talk about what you think about me." It may be a joke. It might not be a true story, but. But whether or not we say that, that's kind of how we talk sometimes. That's enough about me. Let's talk about what you think about me. So the self-forgetfulness of humility, I think, allows us to love other people as other people, and it actually frees us to enjoy other people. Something else I'm not going to get into too much. Self-forgetfulness also frees us to have wonder in the world, to actually look around us and marvel at things that aren't in our own heads. But we can talk about that more later. That's an aspect of humility, wonder. Lastly, maybe most importantly, humility as the imitation of Christ. And this is one of the things that makes the Christian faith utterly unique and strange. We're not only called to be humble before God, we're called to be humble like God. And that is strange to me, because we're called to be humble with God Himself as our model for humility. And the obvious question is, this, you know, if a Martian showed up in this room right now and heard that, the obvious question would be, what kind of God is this? You know, who is this God if we're supposed to humble ourselves before Him as the infinite creator and sustainer of the world and look to Him as our model for how to be humble? That sounds weird to me, and I've heard it many times. God Himself came to show us, and not just tell us, what a true human being looks like. And in order to do this, He He took on human flesh. The second person of the Trinity became a man. And try as hard as you like, you'll never find a greater example of downward mobility, if you think about it. God becoming a human being. This is the doctrine of the incarnation. And C.S. Lewis called it the great miracle. So God was capable of becoming a human being. All the miracles Jesus performed during his lifetime sort of follow. They make sense. The great miracle is the fact that he became a human being at all in the first place. The Christmas story. Jesus never gave up his identity as God. He never stopped being the second person of the Trinity. But he did give up the status. He gave up his power, his safety, his divine prerogatives, his rights and entitlements. He essentially gave up all the benefits of being God. And he came to a world that he knew would not know him. This is something that the prologue in John's Gospel talks about. And yet the world did not know him. The world was made through him, and yet the world did not know him. This is the world Jesus knew he was entering into, the world that would not know him, a world that would not celebrate his coming, really, and that actually would resist him at every turn. He was born into conflict and resistance and stayed there his whole life. So as a human being, Christ placed himself in a position of radical dependence, I think, on his Father, on his Heavenly Father. In a sense, he has this immediate communion with his Heavenly Father. He is one with the Father, and yet he prays all the time. He asks his Father for things. There's an aspect of discipline there in his relationship with God because he's a human being. But he also placed himself in radical dependence, I think, on ordinary people. This is amazing to me. Jesus was an itinerant preacher, among other things. Think of all the people who fed him and offered him places to stay when he traveled around teaching. Think of him being fed by his parents when he was too small to care for himself. He was dependent on other people's charity his whole life. He was trained in carpentry and maybe made some money making furniture or something like that. But in terms of his ministry, he was constantly being cared for by other people and allowing himself to accept charity. So at the incarnation, at God becoming flesh, God made himself need food. He made himself need shelter. He made himself need water and sleep. He took on flesh so that he would be capable of bleeding and dying. So he made himself killable. And during his lifetime, he spent most of his time and energy teaching about humility and undermining the pride of the people he met. That was his task so often. So both by words and by example, Jesus lifts up humility as the way to live. It's God's view of what human excellence looks like. And not God's view told to us. It's God's view shown to us of what human excellence looks like. Many scholars have pointed out that Jesus, with help from Paul, made humility into a virtue. And I think humility was certainly a virtue in the Jewish tradition in the Old Testament, going back to the very beginning. But it's easy to assume today that humility must have always been thought of as a good thing. But in the Greco-Roman world, before Jesus and Paul, humility was basically a vice or a character flaw. A humble slave could be humble because that was simply them staying in their place. They're supposed to be lowly and servile. That's appropriate. But a humble aristocrat was a moral failure in some ways. It was a failure to live up to their rightful station in society. It was to deny their proper privilege. It was a sign of weakness. It might even destabilize the necessary hierarchies of Roman society. If you have upper class patrician people behaving humbly, it would upset the order. Upper class people should lord it over peasants. There's an ethical should there. They had a duty to exercise their upper class prerogatives. Without it, there could be chaos. And so it wasn't really a virtue, at least not universally for everybody. But Paul and Jesus come along and they offer a very, very different picture of what it means to be humble. I'm going to look specifically at what Paul says in Philippians 2. And we're going to sort of circle around this passage quite a bit for the rest of the lecture. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of the others. In your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, who, being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. This is thought to be an ancient hymn text, actually. This is quoting some kind of text that would have been known in liturgical setting in the early church, probably. But the whole life of Christ, as revealed in the Gospels, I think plays out all the ways in which this passage from Philippians 2 is true. Christ is a model of humility, and to imitate him means to do what Paul is saying. Try to have the same mindset towards our brothers and sisters as Christ had when he emptied himself for you. Stop clinging to what you believe is your status. Think harder about the needs of someone else than about your own needs. And be willing to humble yourself out of love for those people. This is what Jesus did. And because he did it, God glorified him and gave him the name above every name. And so this is, you know, the ultimate sign that this is God's approval. This is human greatness to God. And so there's much more to say about Jesus' life and the ways in which he showed us what humility looked like, the circumstances around his birth, thought to be illegitimate, no place to be born. Within the first 2 years of his life, he was a refugee, fleeing to Egypt. Later in life, his insistence that his cousin John baptize him, his insistence on spending time with people who could not benefit him in any way, but only actually brought criticism on him. There's the story in John 13 that we already read about him washing his disciples' feet. The part I didn't read was the part right before that, where it says, Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So this is his transcendence. He's aware of who he is. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with a towel that was wrapped around him. So that is it. That is a as dramatic a sort of contrast as we could ask for. He was aware that he was going to be glorified by God. He was returning to God. And what does he do? He washes feet. There's his submission to his Father in Gethsemane when he says, "Not my will, but yours be done." There's his silence at his trial. I think this is one of the most impressive things about Jesus, his ability to stay silent in the face of lies, false accusations, being misrepresented completely. All kinds of things that we could talk about. And finally, his death, accepting the shame of crucifixion. I think Philippians 2 is written out of a deep reflection on the life of Christ. An amazing thing about Philippians 2, actually, is that the word that's translated being, it's the part that, I'll just underline it here, the part that says being in very nature God, has usually, in the past, and certainly I've read it in this way, been read to mean this: in spite of the fact that he was God, or even though he was God, he took on the form of a servant, right? That's how I think it's very often read. And this makes, there's a logic to this. Even though he was the God of the universe, he emptied himself and took on the form of a servant. And Greek scholars will tell you that grammatically what's going on there is the verb being is used as a concessive verb, which means despite being in his nature God, he emptied himself. But there's many scholars that offer a different reading of that verb. And a better reading, they would say, is in a causative sense, which means it would read like this. Precisely because he was in his very nature God, he did not grasp for equality, but poured himself out and humbled himself. So there's a big difference between those two. The first reading is, despite the fact that he was God, that's concessive. Or, because he was God, he did this. That's causative. A good friend of ours, who actually lectured here not too long ago, Beth Pocock, she gave a sermon on humility, and this is something that she was talking about, and this is what Beth said. Looking at it with this understanding, she's talking about the causative. We perceive here that the sheer goodness of God, Jesus did not take on the outward form of a servant in order to disguise who God is, or cover up who God really is. Jesus took on the outward form of a servant in order to reveal who God is. God is the infinite servant. Humility lies at the very center of God's heart. Jesus came in humility precisely because of the fact that he is God. So it is God being who God is. It's God's relentless pursuing love for us. The life and death of Christ are not some exception or compromise to who God is. They are a display of who he is. So when we look at Jesus' life all the way down to his willingness to suffer disgrace and death, we're seeing a clear revelation of the character of God the Father. All the grit and the shame and the nonsense and pain that Jesus endures in life is God showing us who he really is. It was because he was God, not despite of his being God, that he emptied himself to save us. And the amazing thing is, Jesus humbled himself to save us from our pride, the guilt of our pride, that we could not rid ourselves of on our own. Our failure to be humble is why he came and humbled himself. So the point here, I think, is that this fact alone, that this is who God is, this is the type of God we're worshiping, the one who, it's in his character to empty himself out of love, this should humble us. This is a source of humility for the Christian. The lengths that God would go to include us in his family again. The God who holds the whole universe together at the same time as the one who empties himself for us. And secondly, I think when God calls us to the very hard, lifelong task of humility, he's not asking us to do anything that he hasn't done himself. The master who we are called to humbly follow is a humble master. When he invites people to follow him in Matthew 11, he reminds people of what he's like. Think about who you're following. And he says this, take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. In other words, imitate me in my humility. I will treat you gently, because I am humble, and you'll find rest. It's a wonderful picture. Like, you know, think of all the pompous, self-inflated leaders we could follow, and all the people we could swear allegiance to, and they're not even God. But God himself is gentle and humble in heart. So Jesus is a good master to follow and submit to. And he's, again, like I said earlier, it's not simply about humbling ourselves before him. It's about being humble like him. And that to me is sort of mind blowing, and should refresh in us a sense of the uniqueness of the Christian faith. There's nothing else like this anywhere. I think I'm just going to conclude by saying, just where are some places where we can be renewed or seek humility? And I think creation is one of them. I think looking to creation to be reminded that we're finite, that we are creatures, we're actually a part of creation, even though we stand in a special place in creation, we're a part of it. We're dependent on God. And when we look to creation, we can see God's grandeur and a glimpse of His limitless creativity. And that can fill us with the humility of wonder. We talked about wonder a minute ago. But wonder, true wonder, takes a measure of humility. And then I think also the cross is one of the places we go. Looking to Christ's sacrifice to be reminded of our need for forgiveness, our inability to fix ourselves, and to be reminded of God's amazing eagerness to cancel our debts and welcome us home. So I'm going to end by reading two hymn texts, both by Isaac Watts, who is the best hymn writer. You heard it here. Who's my favorite hymn writer? And the first is "I Sing the Mighty Power of God," and this is an example of what I was talking about going to creation for renewed humility. But I think it's wonderful because Watts is encouraging us to look both high and low in creation, all over creation, in order to perceive the glory of God and the power of God. And it goes like this. We won't sing it. I'll just read it. Actually, I think I have it here. Yes, good, okay. "I sing the mighty power of God that made the mountains rise, that spread the flowing seas abroad and built the lofty skies. I sing the wisdom that ordained the sun to rule the day. The moon shines full at God's command, and all the stars obey. I sing the goodness of the Lord, who filled the earth with food, who formed the creatures through His word, and then pronounced them good. Lord, how Thy wonders are displayed where'er I turn my eye, if I survey the ground I tread or gaze upon the sky. There's not a plant or flower below but makes Thy glories known. The clouds arise and tempests blow by order from Thy throne. While all that borrows life from Thee is ever in Thy care, and everywhere that we can be, Thou God art present there." It's just an awesome reflection on creation. Wherever we go, wherever we look, if we have the eyes to see it, we'll see the glory of God. And we, just in case we forgot, that we also borrow life from Him. It's borrowed. And then the second place we go to find renewed humility is the cross. And this is maybe His most famous hymn, which is "When I Survey the Wondrous Cross." It's interesting, the same word is used in the previous hymn, "When I Survey..." Where is it? Sorry.
Last line.
If I survey the ground or tread or gaze upon the sky. Thank you. I had a professor in grad school who talked about Isaac Watts as sort of writing into the context of the Enlightenment, in which the human being was seen as the measure of all things. Man was viewed as being in a position of evaluating the world, measuring the world, surveying the world. And his hymn, "When I Survey the Wondrous Cross," is kind of a into the face of that reality, and in a way, kind of deflating that that inflated view of what the human being is. And so there's a lot that we can survey and measure and evaluate about the world, but when we come to the cross, we're kind of undone. We're not in the same position we were before. And Watts encourages us to look at the cross and allow it to actually control how we view everything else in our lives. And so this is "When I Survey the Wondrous Cross." "When I survey the wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory died, my richest gain I count but loss and pour contempt on all my pride. Forbid it, Lord, that I should boast, save in the death of Christ my God. All the vain things that charm me most, I sacrifice them to His blood. See from His head, His hands, His feet, sorrow and love flow mingled down. Did e'er such love and sorrow meet, or thorns compose so rich a crown? Were the whole realm of nature mine, that were a present far too small. Love so amazing, so divine, demands my soul, my life, my all." And so our professor was really pointing to particularly to that last verse. Being, you know, into a time in which these ideas were developing, that man really does stand above all of nature and is in control of his destiny. Watts is saying, actually, the whole realm of nature is not mine, first of all, but even if it was, it would be too small a gift to give back to God for what he's done. And so, helpful hymn, it's worth reflecting on. And that's where I'm going to end. At the break, we like to have time to discuss. So anybody that has questions or comments that they want to make, they can do that. That's great. And we'll go for a little while, and then I'll eventually probably lose my voice. But anybody that needs to leave should feel free to do that. You don't have to stay till the bitter end. But are there any questions or comments? Yeah, Rachel.
So you define humility as admitting that you have a lack for a need, but then how can Christ be humble if he has a need to please God?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Maybe another version of the question. Maybe it's getting at the same thing, which I've been struggling with. But maybe you can say that. Tell me if it's not what you're getting at. If humility, I was trying to argue that humility is just an appropriate response to being finite and being morally broken. If that's what humility is, what does it mean that Jesus is humble? Because it's in a sense, it's inappropriate that he would take on these limitations because he's God.
About that he's dependent upon the Father. For one thing, a lot of people, even human minds, have a hard time grasping how Jesus could be God and talking to God or dependent upon God. But I don't know. I never really searched this out. But I've always thought of we're made in His likeness. Our body doesn't do anything without our mind telling it to do it, right? And